Thanks for tuning in for the January 11th podcast. I'm Jose Merino, Editor-in-Chief of the Neurology Family of Journals. This week's feature interview focuses on a study that investigates the association between the anatomical location of surgical lesions and postoperative seizure outcomes in patients with temporal lobe epilepsy.
Hello, this is Hallie Alexander with the Neurology Podcast. Today, I'm speaking with Ezekiel Gleichgers from Medical University of South Carolina about his exciting new paper that was just published in Neurology titled Association Between Anatomical Location of Surgically Induced Lesions and Postoperative Seizure Outcome in Temporal Lobe Epilepsy. Zeke, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Now, in your study, you retrospectively looked at a cohort of 113 patients to try to determine the association between surgical lesions and surgical outcomes in people who have temporal lobe epilepsy. And you were looking at both the structural lesions and the structural and functional connectivity of those lesions. So can you try to explain as best you can in layman's terms what you did to evaluate this?
Yes, absolutely. And Hallie, if it's okay with you, before we delve into the specifics, perhaps the best way to understand how we approached the study is to remember how neurologists really came to learn throughout centuries about the localization of specific brain functions in general. So if you think about the seminal work of anatomists like Paul Broca or Carl Wernicke, you know, all the way back in the 1800s, it became evident very early on that lesions to specific brain areas lead to very different behavioral and cognitive impairments. That's also how we ended up with cases like HM or Phineas Gage. You know, these are cases that a lot of neurologists have read throughout their training. And the reason that those cases exist is at the end of the day, they're teaching us the relationship between what happens when you cause a lesion to a specific part of the brain in terms of a distinct pattern of cognitive and behavioral disruptions. But of course, throughout these decades and centuries, the major limitation of these approaches was that the observation was being done from a qualitative or at most maybe a semi-quantitative human assessment, right? So we never had a systematic, almost unbiased way of determining what parts of the brain were specifically critical for a specific behavior. So what I mean by that is we're not able from our human eyes alone to create some sort of fine-grained map of brain structures. And when I say fine-grained, I mean very high resolution, right? I want to know millimeter by millimeter which parts of the brain are fundamental for a given behavior or cognitive function or clinical phenotype. In the early 2000s, with the advancement of neuroimaging and computational power, a solution to this limitation was introduced in the literature. And it's the framework that we refer to as lesion symptom mapping. And that's the framework that we took for this study. To make a long story short, you basically study a group of patients that have similar but not identical brain lesions. And at each voxel, and for the record, when I say voxel, I'm talking about each one of those pixels in a brain image, like an MRI. So at each voxel, you can compare how those patients that have a lesion in the voxel versus those patients that don't have a lesion in the voxel, how do they perform on a given task, or what is their specific behavior on a given domain? And by doing so, you can determine which voxels are critical for that cognitive function or behavior. So you can imagine that if you do that for every single voxel, now you can generate this map. And this is really perhaps one of the few, if not the only technique that can reliably and systematically tell us which areas are critically associated with a function. We looked at the association between lesions to specific components of the temporal lobes and seizure outcomes after patients with drug-resistant temporal lobe epilepsy had undergone epilepsy surgery. And we did this for 113 patients from three different level 4 epilepsy centers, two in the US and one in Europe. So in our case, you know, I keep talking about lesions. In our case, lesions refers to the lesions that were caused by the surgery. So these were surgical cavities, surgical lesions. And we included the whole array of surgery types that you can have today in epilepsy surgery. So we had patients that underwent laser ablation, patients that had more conservative resections, for example, a selective amygdalohippocampectomy, and also more radical resections, for example, anterior temporal lobectomies. And that's a plus for the study because one of the biggest assets for lesion symptom mapping is a wide variability of surgical lesions that have different extents, not just in terms of volume, but also in what parts of those temporal lobes they are causing an injury to. So again, to recap the framework, at each voxel, we compare the seizure outcome in our case between those patients whose surgery included that voxel and those whose surgery spared that 1 millimeter brain tissue. So that's the core premise of the study. But the reality of epilepsy and the way we understand epilepsy today is really as a disease of networks, not so much a disease that is confined to just the gray matter anymore. And so we extended this idea of lesion symptom mapping, not just to the structural voxels, but also to connectivity-based mapping. So in our studies previously, we had shown that you can understand also the critical association between white matter pathways and behavior. And so that's what we did here too. We not only looked at those voxels that were lesioned versus non-lesioned, but also what happened when patients had spared versus loss of white matter pathways in the temporal lobes. And that same model, we applied it for functional connectivity. So we looked at which two structures at a given time lost their ability to co-activate, meaning activate simultaneously, and how that loss led to one seizure outcome versus the other. The long story short is that we can do all of these analyses to try and understand the critical association between structure, structural connectivity, and functional connectivity, in our case with seizure outcome. But there are all these other variables that we know are important for seizure outcomes per se. And so we accounted for all of those by covariating our analyses or controlling our analyses for the total amount of surgical resection volume, the volume of hippocampi before surgery, because you can imagine that if you start out with larger hippocampi, meaning less atrophy, of course, you're going to have more hippocampi removed at surgery, and that could be a factor to account for. We also accounted for site of surgery. There's a lot of literature suggesting that right temporal lobe epilepsy and left temporal lobe epilepsy may be distinct diseases, even though the underlying pathophysiology is very similar. And we also accounted, of course, for the site where the patient was treated, because this was a multi-site study, and we pulled together patients from these three different level 4 epilepsy centers.
Excellent. I'm very impressed that you're able to really distill that down to the essentials and explain that in a way that makes sense and that many of our neurologists can relate to, because we are used to kind of learning neuroanatomy and neurological function, lesion by lesion or stroke by stroke, as they say. With all that being said, what were the findings from your study?
Essentially, we found that patients whose surgical lesion extended to the amygdala piriform cortex complex and the entorhinal cortex had better seizure outcomes. But when we extended also to these other modalities, we also found that surgical disconnection of the temporal, frontal, and limbic regions through very specific white matter pathways, particularly the uncinate fasciculus, the anterior commissure, and the fornix. So when patients lost those connections, they actually fared better postoperatively. And finally, we saw that patients that were seizure-free also had decreased functional co-activation of frontal and temporal structures. So we're giving this neuroanatomical perspective of what disconnections and what losses of gray matter are important in patients that achieved seizure freedom.
That's very interesting. And it makes sense because we generally find that, you know, bigger resection volume is usually associated with a better surgical outcome. But of course, we also generally try to take out as little brain as is needed to achieve seizure freedom. So can you explain, like, does resecting all of these multiple different areas in one surgery, would that come at a cost? So for example, if you resect or disconnect all these areas you mentioned, would that have implications for post-op changes in cognition, emotion, memory, language, things like that?
Absolutely. And I think that's the million-dollar question. You nailed it, right? Because we still don't have those answers. When we put patients through surgery, when we recommend surgery, we do so believing that they will come seizure-free, but only 2/3 of them do. And we do so accounting for possible undesirable side effects of surgery. But we're still not great at predicting which patients will have problems with naming, problems with memory, and so on and so forth. The way the field is moving, I think, is really trying to find that perfect balance between a surgery that renders the patient seizure-free, but without the devastating consequences to quality of life, including all the things that you and I mentioned, memory, language, emotional processing, mood, and so on and so forth. We're getting closer, but we still need a lot of these lesion symptom maps to try and understand across all these modalities and all of these dimensions of human behavior and affection and cognition, how it is that we can find that perfect balance.
Right. And I'm just curious, is that something that you could look at, like in this cohort, for example, with your voxels and their like cognitive outcomes? Could you look at that?
Yeah, in fact, we're doing that. So we're approaching the same framework, but instead of having seizure outcome as the variable of interest, you can apply the same model to naming, different aspects of memory. And so we're trying to create these maps that then hopefully will be able to overlap and tell the neurosurgeons, hey, look, when you remove or you laser this specific portion, the likelihood of becoming seizure-free is this much higher, but the likelihood of becoming anomic is also this much higher. And so then you start pulling together information about the pre-surgical workup, information about the patient's willingness to go through some side effects that are undesirable. You know, not every patient values naming as much. Maybe if their jobs are not as demanding of an ability to retrieve words, they might not care as long as we're providing more likelihood of seizure freedom. I think that's where the beauty of this approach lies, which is that it really renders a much more reliable way of counseling our patients and making a decision together with them of what they're willing to risk for specific potential benefits.
Yeah, it really is helping us refine our ability to kind of predict both outcomes and particular risks or costs of the surgery. So does this paper then suggest that we should be adjusting our surgical practices now and maybe targeting all these areas in our temporal lobe surgery patients? Or what would you say is the best way to try to incorporate what you've learned here into clinical practice?
I think certainly the idea that we have to revisit the way we are targeting different aspects of the temporal lobes. So that's a great question also in terms of understanding how our field is moving. Because at the end of the day, with less invasive procedures like laser ablation, for example, a lot of centers are becoming very comfortable in going back and providing a revision laser before they move on to a open resection. So much so that some centers have offered even 3 revisions. And so the question is, should these revisions be targeting these extra structures if in the first post-op imaging, we find that maybe the amygdala piriform cortex was not destroyed by the laser or that the entorhinal cortex is still spared? And I think as we learn more about the lesion symptom mapping of memory and naming and mood and so on and so forth, that's where we'll be able to make these decisions. So we're getting close. We still need quite a bit more research that pulls together all of these different dimensions of just being a human, right?
Yeah, that's a good point that maybe it doesn't all need to be done up front, but it's something you could target for repeat surgeries. So how much of these areas you mentioned and disconnections and everything, how much can that be done with the laser as opposed to an open resection?
Different surgeons will give us different answers. And I think it's a matter of understanding the trajectories that each patient allows in their brain, so their neuroanatomical constraints, and there are certainly expansions of the thermal lesion that is caused by a single trajectory of the laser. So what a lot of centers are doing is they're targeting the majority of the hippocampus amygdala, for example, with the first laser, and then in a second revision, they might be going back to laser the posterior part of the hippocampus, which a lot of times does not get lasered with that first trajectory. We also know that some centers are starting to target some of the lateral aspects of the temporal lobe with laser. And I think how much that sticks around will depend on results like the results from the study, right? Just looking at how more specific and narrow lesions contribute to different outcomes.
We could talk about this all day, really, but in order to wrap up, is there anything else you would want to mention about this exciting research before we go?
Sure. And I agree, it's certainly very exciting. I think the more we can provide of a tailored experience for our patients, the better it is, right? It's at the end of the day, I think you nailed it when you talked about the other undesirable side effects of surgery. Seizure outcome is only one of many variables that we have to essentially proactively approach in our discussion with patients. But epilepsy surgery needs to be understood from every possible angle in terms of what would have an impact in terms of patients' quality of life, functional outcomes, and whether that's cognitive, affective, behavioral, and so on and so forth. So the way I think about how our field needs to move to answer these questions is really that the best way to achieve this is to pull together multi-centric, multimodal, multidimensional data to answer questions that can be statistically reliable, but more importantly, generalizable, right? At the end of the day, that's the kind of study that will allow us to answer questions that matter for all patients with temporal lobe epilepsy. So it's definitely a very exciting time for epilepsy research.
Yeah, very much so. And you brought up an important issue there. So, you know, you're talking about tailored treatments as well as getting a lot of data from multiple centers, multiple modalities to generalize to patients. So I'm kind of wondering, like, for example, in an individual patient who maybe has reorganization because they've had a brain injury in the past, how would you apply what you know from this kind of mapping where correct me if I'm wrong, but it looks like you're looking at databases of normal brains to compare to. So if you have an individual patient who you might suspect might have a different type of anatomy compared to the general population, how could you take that into account?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think the way is twofold. One, we are only telling one part of the story here, and it's the post-operative side of the story. But a lot of the research from our lab previously has also focused and continues to focus on whether we can predict preoperatively who is likely to become seizure-free. And that's going to the point that you raised, which is there's reorganization. And that reorganization happens preoperatively, right? We know that if you look at changes in the brain of patients with focal epilepsy, those changes are absolutely not confined to the area of presumed seizure focus. Rather, we see, for example, in patients with medial temporal lobe epilepsy, that those changes occur not only in the ipsilateral, more neocortical aspect of the temporal lobes, but also extratemporally and more impressively so, contralateral to the area of seizure focus. And that's why we say that epilepsy is a disease of networks. So as we move towards personalized medicine in epilepsy surgery, we will have to account for both sides of the story. So by that, I mean trying to predict who's likely to benefit from the surgery in the preoperative state, and then trying to understand what we can specifically target to make that likelihood even higher. In terms of the other side of the story, you're absolutely right that in order to understand how this could change at the patient level, what we need is to get large data sets that have patient-specific data that is multimodal. So we would want to do this with the patient's own structural, but also diffusion and fMRI data. So we're collecting all those data. For the study, we used for the structural connectivity and the functional connectivity standard sets of data acquired in humans that are considered neurotypical. And the reason for that is that we wanted to have this disconnectogram, right? This map of what structures get disconnected and what pathways are affected if we were to have a normal adult brain template and the lesion that the patient had generated during the surgery located in that specific neuroanatomical region. And so I think when you pull together all of these things that we just discussed, that's how we're going to be able to converge the models and have the highest reliability and accuracy to predict seizure benefit, but also epilepsy surgery benefit in general for patients with not only temporal lobe epilepsy, but you'll be able to expand this to other forms of focal epilepsy surgery.
That's so exciting. Thank you for explaining that. And thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, it was my pleasure. Thank you so much, Hallie.
Again, I've been speaking with Ezekiel Gleichgerst regarding his study on postoperative seizure outcomes in temporal lobe epilepsy that was recently published in Neurology. We look forward to seeing more of your work, Zeke.
Thank you. Have a great day.
This has been another episode of the Neurology Podcast. your best source of practical, relevant, and timely information for neurologists, clinicians, and patients. The views and opinions of the participants in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the journal Neurology or the AAN. Disclosures of the participants are included in the show descriptions, reached by a link on the neurology.org website.